Chapter 2. War in Europe. The End of American Neutrality. Pearl Harbor would become a defining event in the Second World War for America. But it took place more than 2 years after Germany's invasion of Poland in 1939 had sparked the conflict. In the intervening period, the U.S. had to find answers to questions of morality, finance, and politics as its leaders sought the best course of action. As America withdrew back into isolationism following the Senate's rejection of the League of Nations, the Republicans would also take control of the White House for more than a decade after Democratic President Woodrow Wilson left office in 1921. By the time his fellow party member Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected in 1932, non-interventionism was the dominant school of thought, and the new president had to concentrate on dragging America out of the slump that followed the Wall Street crash. At the same time, the fragile peace that the League of Nations had established in Europe was on the verge of collapse, and it would not be long before the U.S. would be unwillingly drawn into a second European war in 25 years. Roosevelt's quarantine speech. For the entirety of the 1930s, particularly in the first half, America was preoccupied with the crippling economic turmoil which had followed the crumbling of its stock market in October 1929. The Wall Street crash had left the U.S. on its knees, and there were consequences all over the world. Those effects had a significant role in the rising tensions throughout Europe as many people turned their backs on the governments of the day in favor of ambitious new leaders who swept to power, sometimes by force, and often on a platform of nationalism. After brutally consolidating his rule over Germany, Adolf Hitler sought domination over the continent and began the rearmament of his military in earnest, something which went against international law and contravened the terms of the Versailles Peace Treaty. America, along with Britain and France, had neither the inclination nor the strength to offer any real resistance, and this only encouraged Hitler to continue as he expanded his Nazi party and set about building an empire. In Italy, Benito Mussolini's fascism movement took hold, as did the nationalists in Spain, led by Army General Francisco Franco, who coordinated an uprising against the democratically elected government. Concern over these developments dominated the foreign policy approach of the first Roosevelt administration, but with overwhelming support for isolationism from within his own government and inaction on the part of more friendly European nations, he could do nothing to intervene. Indeed, shortly after taking office, Roosevelt proposed that he should be able to consult with other nations to place pressure on foreign aggressors in times of international conflict. But the bill ran into strong opposition from isolationist members of the House of Representatives. Americans, politically and publicly, remained convinced that the involvement in the First World War had been a mistake, and hearings led by Senator Gerald Nye in 1934 and 1935, revealed that international bankers and arms dealers had encouraged Woodrow Wilson to enter the conflict and had enjoyed significant profits, which only served to harden the stance. Peace movements spread on college campuses, too, and the growing European immigrant population in the U.S. generally supported the rise of nationalist movements in their own countries, even when they were being driven by dictatorial governments. History was playing its part as well, and isolationists had plenty of precedent to draw upon, as they invoked the words of George Washington and the other American forefathers who had advocated non-involvement in the European wars of the 19th century, and had allowed the natural buffers of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans to keep them detached from the affairs of the Old World. In 1935, much to Roosevelt's dismay, U.S. lawmakers began to pass a series of neutrality acts, which prohibited American citizens from traveling on the ships of belligerents, and the sale of arms to countries deemed to be at war. These edicts were aimed at preventing situations similar to those which had occurred prior to the First World War, Americans dying at sea as a result of German submarine attacks, and German leaders rejecting American neutrality on the basis of the U.S. supplying aid and arms to other nations. Both had been crucial to American entry into the conflict in 1917, and the isolationists would go to any lengths to prevent a repeat. Roosevelt, who had to maintain support for his domestic stimulus package known as the New Deal, had little choice but to accept. As the decade progressed, the president became more and more concerned with the actions of Hitler in Germany, who had now begun his campaign against the nation's Jewish population, stripping them of their citizenship and their property, and deporting them. He decided it was time to act, and in 1937 delivered what became known as the Quarantine Speech. In it, and without referencing any individual state or person, he called for an international quarantine of aggressor nations, as he likened such actions of brutality to a disease. Initial reaction from within America saw the isolationists dig in even deeper, and non-interventionists launched protests. The media also hit back, and the address was criticized in several newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune and the New York Sun, the latter featuring a 2-page advertisement lamenting Roosevelt, which was paid for and created by famed cartoonist Percy Crosby. But despite the vitriol, over time, the stance taken in the Quarantine Speech began to gain some support, and propaganda critical of isolationism began to appear. Despite this murmuring of support for involvement in the European wars, Roosevelt had few options on the table, and emphatically stated that the U.S. would not be part of any formal alliance to stop Hitler. In Europe, appeasement prevailed, and in the Munich Conference of 1938, Hitler's annexation of parts of Czechoslovakia was ratified as the leaders of Britain and France sought to avoid all-out war, hoping that Germany's expansionism had peaked. That hope lasted a little less than a year, as Germany and the Soviet Union put their differences aside to sign a non-aggression pact, allowing Hitler to invade Poland. Appeasement was no longer an option, as both Britain and France, who had both pledged to protect Poland from German aggression, declared war. Lend-lease and military aid. Within a year of the outbreak of the Second World War, the Nazi Blitzkrieg, against little opposition, had overrun Poland, much of Scandinavia, Belgium, and the Netherlands. And by June 1940, its forces occupied Paris and dominated vast territories of North Africa. For nearly 2 years before America did eventually enter the war, Britain stood against Hitler in Europe alone and vowed to repel the threat of a German invasion by all means necessary. In the Battle of Britain, 1940 and 1941, the Royal Air Force managed to combat a relentless offensive by the Luftwaffe, which inspired British Prime Minister Winston Churchill to famously declare, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few." In another historic speech, known primarily for its line, "We shall fight on the beaches," Churchill also made a direct plea to Roosevelt when he called on the New World to step forward with all its power and might and liberate the European powers that were under siege. The U.S. leader believed Hitler's aggression posed a direct threat to his country. But even after the war had begun, the prevalent feeling in America was still towards isolationism. And the German premier actually had more than a few admirers in America who believed he would suppress the spread of communism. Even before 1939, though, Roosevelt had made moves to support Britain, France, and the other Allied forces against the German onslaught. In that year, he described the two European nations as America's first line of defense, and decided that they needed American aid. To provide this, he circumvented the various neutrality acts by allowing France to make huge orders of American aircraft on a cash-and-carry basis, ensuring that money was received up front, unlike in the First World War, when it became clear the European powers did not have the funds to repay their debts. Once Germany had conquered France and installed its puppet Vichy government, Roosevelt arranged for the French orders to be delivered to the British instead. The fall of Paris sent shockwaves across America, as pro-intervention groups began to formalize and provide genuine opposition to the isolationists. In practical terms, there was support from American businesses for an increase in arms, both for its own defense and for sale, as it provided a potentially vast revenue stream only 10 years on from the Wall Street crash, although leading military figures opposed the sale of arms and equipment, insisting that America should increase its own stockpiles instead. With the public opposing direct military involvement, war was still not an option, and so Roosevelt had to develop initiatives which complied with congressional laws, satisfied military and business leaders, and were acceptable to U.S. citizens. In September 1940, Roosevelt signed a Destroyers for Bases agreement, whereby the U.S. provided Britain with more than 50 obsolete destroyers in exchange for 99-year leases on territory in Newfoundland and the Caribbean, which would be used as U.S. air and naval bases. Later that year, Churchill warned Roosevelt that Britain was struggling financially and could no longer purchase items on a cash-and-carry basis, forcing the U.S. to propose a new initiative that would be known as Lend-Lease. America would provide military supplies for the fight against Germany, but there were two caveats. The supplies would be lent on the promise of payment at a later date, and payment would not come in the form of cash, but instead Britain pledged to support American aims of a liberalized global economic model for the post-war world. Despite contravening the Neutrality Act, Congress approved the Lend-Lease Bill in 1941, and the debate which preceded its passing also saw Roosevelt block attempts to exclude the Soviet Union from receiving U.S. assistance. This was a significant strategic victory for the president, who was convinced a Russian alliance would be crucial to defeating Germany after Hitler had reneged on his non-aggression pact with Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. The Atlantic Charter. With military supplies and aid starting to flow from America to countries in Europe, and other nations across the world who were opposed to Hitler and the Axis powers, Roosevelt began to promote his own vision for the type of global society he wished to see develop once fighting had ended. The situation at home was still fragile in the wake of the Wall Street crash, and the world was at war. So Roosevelt made the unprecedented move of seeking a third term in office, arguing that the unpredictability of a new president could jeopardize causes both in America and abroad. He enjoyed a wide margin of victory in both the Electoral College and the popular vote, and finally had both the mandate and means to pursue his foreign policy aims, albeit still without support for direct U.S. military involvement in the war. In his 1941 State of the Union address, Roosevelt channeled Wilson's 14 points to present his own four freedoms: freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. Having pioneered the use of mass communication methods, such as radio, to communicate directly with the electorate, a week prior to the Four Freedoms speech, he had used one of his fireside chat addresses to declare that America should be the arsenal of democracy. And his personable and engaging approach garnered support from the people as he slowly but surely laid out the case for American intervention. Roosevelt met Churchill in August 1941 in Newfoundland, and the president's ideals for how the world would look once the conflict had ended were high on the agenda. The two drafted an agreement which included 8 common principles, covering issues such as free trade, worldwide welfare standards, and the prevention of territorial expansion. Crucially, both leaders committed their respective countries to supporting the restoration of democratically chosen and elected forms of self-government for nations that were occupied during the Second World War. The joint document that emerged from the meeting was the Atlantic Charter, and, although not a binding treaty, it was significant in establishing a sense of official solidarity between Great Britain and the U.S. against German aggression. More importantly, though, it translated the 4 freedoms of Roosevelt into genuine Allied aims, and the president went about bolstering their support, at various times comparing them to the 10 Commandments, the Magna Carta, and the Emancipation Proclamation. In a nation that was still blighted by discrimination against various sections of its own society, the 4 freedoms also gave Americans the sense that they were fighting for their own freedoms, and not just those of people more than 3,000 miles away across the oceans. Roosevelt's pact with Churchill was one of the final pieces of the jigsaw as he moved closer to majority support for American involvement in the Second World War. There was certainly no neutrality as U.S. backing came down firmly on the side of the Allies, and the president had tapped into those old dreams of manifest destiny with his vision of a free and democratic world. America was on the precipice, but it would take something seismic to finally break the chains of isolationism. As focus continued on the events occurring in Europe, it was rising tensions and a devastating attack in the Pacific, which would be the eventual catalyst for American entry.